I'm John Kroll. On today's No Limits, we're going to kick around the proposed stadium plans for the Indy 11 professional soccer team. We'll talk about where things stand and where they might go. My guests are Indy 11 owner Ersal Özdemir, Indy 11 CEO Greg Stemlaw, and IUPUI Director of Sports Innovation Institute David Pierce. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about what lies ahead for the Indy 11 professional soccer team. We'll talk about where things stand and where they might go. If you want to join the conversation, and I would imagine that the many soccer fans in this town would want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Indy 11 owner Ersal Özdemir, Indy 11 CEO Greg Stemlaw, and the director of IUPUI's Sports Innovation Institute, David Pierce. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. So, I'll tell you what, I'll start with Ersal. There has been some news, obviously, the fact that, the plans for a new stadium and all of that have been working their way through the Indiana General Assembly. Can you talk about where that is right now?
Thanks for having me.
Oh, certainly.
11 Park is the name of the project. 11 Park is a neighborhood transformational project in Marion County. We're looking at several sites that are currently abandoned that do not generate any property taxes or any jobs. And we plan to invest $400 million privately to build hotel, office building, retail shops, and multifamily apartments, all consistent with a 20,000 seat with a professional soccer stadium, a multi-purpose stadium that would also host NCAA, high school games, American football, lacrosse, rugby, concerts, and community events. That bill was presented in the Senate, got rolled into Senate Bill 7. The CIB bill passed the Senate 48-1. It's moved to the House of Representatives in Ways and Means Committee this week.
Yeah, and it starts through that process. That's the typical process. It originates in one chamber of the legislature and moves over. Obviously, 48-1 indicates that there was a fair amount of support for it. But, Greg, I'll let you pick up the narrative next. This is really only the first step in some ways, or one of the early steps in the dance to bring Major League Soccer to Indianapolis and Indiana. You talk about where we are in that process and what some of those other steps would be.
Well, I think the big thing to realize is we want the stadium and the development regardless of Major League Soccer. So that's an added benefit if that comes along with it. We feel that there's more than enough need for a professional soccer stadium, to Ersal's point, to house our fans, to ensure that we have a soccer-specific stadium that's there, that's built for soccer, that we can control our own schedule, our own destiny, and the community desperately needs it. So just wanted to make sure there's a clarity on that. In addition to that, if we happen to get that done and Major League Soccer wants to be part of that, of course, then we've set the table for that to occur.
And you have applied, though, right? I mean, you've expressed interest.
That's correct.
In part of this. So it sounds like in some ways there's a plan A and a plan B. Is that correct, or is it?
Well, I mean, we've applied. I think plan A right now is to make sure that we get the stadium that this team and the city and the state needs for soccer. So I don't know if I'd call them plan A and plan B. I think that's the number one motivating driver Behind that, though, as discussions continue with Major League Soccer, we want them to be aware that we're pushing forward with a professional soccer stadium here.
So let me stay with you for a second. What are the growth options then, if the Indy 11 don't become? I don't know what the whether the grammar would be there, whether it's don't or doesn't, whether the team doesn't become a Major League Soccer
franchise. Well, we think we can fill the stadium regardless of whether we're in the USL or MLS. But at this point, what's been spec'd is two minimum specifications for Major League Soccer to ensure that we're able to adhere to their guidelines. Should that be a next step in the process?
Okay, and David, this is not an unusual child. There are other communities in this country who are dealing with this right now. Correct.
Sure, yeah. You know, St. Louis and Phoenix, Vegas, Sacramento, Detroit, Raleigh, Charlotte, all those folks are in the game for this 28th MLS franchise.
And that's pretty much the roster of the, along with Indianapolis, of the hungry and aggressive cities in America. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, and, you know, they were at 24 franchises a few years ago, and they've added Cincinnati, Miami, Nashville, and Austin here in recent years. So to put that, I guess 23, now up at a 27, looking for a 28th.
What accounts, because, you know, it's still a relatively new phenomenon here in the United States. That's pretty remarkable growth in a relatively short, because basically if we're talking 28 franchises, I think Major League Baseball has 30. You know, basically it has become a fourth major sport in a short period. I want to hear everybody's thoughts on what accounts for that. I'll start with David, but we'll take it back around the horn.
Well, I think the MLS is you know, been successful there in its first decade. I mean, I think that really helped. I think there was a lot of skepticism early, but I think as, you know, participation in youth soccer here in America becomes, you know, more predominant just in the fabric of, you know, what you think your kids are going to go out and participate in, I think that creates some interest early. And then, you know, just with the availability of, you know, all the technology and the internet to be able to get, you know, highlights on your phone and all those sorts of things, it makes soccer a lot more accessible than maybe what it was in the mid-90s, where you really had to wait for a little two-minute segment on SportsCenter to catch a clip of something you were interested in.
Greg?
I think the sport is truly finally resonating with North Americans the way it is in the rest of the world. I think, you know, people that live here are finally starting to realize why it is the world's game and it is the beautiful game. And as David said, accessibility is huge. But I also think as demographics have continued to shift, diversity, we're seeing so many different people from around the world that are really starting to come to North America, and that is their sport, and we're seeing the growth with that. Of course, the excitement around 2026 World Cup, that's going to act as a clear magnet, in my opinion, towards driving it even further. It's going to be a complete different game than 1994. The fact that it is really a North American situation from a FIFA World Cup bid and hosting, with Canada and Mexico also being involved. And listen, I just came from broadcast media. You know, I used to run the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation for all the other sports platforms. Mm-hmm. I've watched these metrics and these numbers for this sport in particular continue to grow and grow. That's going to be a big engine towards driving leagues, whether it's USL, whether it's MLS, et cetera. I think there's further heightened frugality that's going to come out of that.
How much, I'm going to stay with you for a second, then I promise I'll give Ursal a chance to deal with that question too. How much of it is the concern really about, and I noticed we refer to it as American football here, you know what, in this country we refer to as football, the rest of the world, it's just this strange sport that people play. How much of that is that, because we have seen and we've done shows here before about how participation levels in youth American football leagues are dropping dramatically over parents' concerns for injuries and all of that. And correspondingly, participation in youth soccer leagues has exploded. How much of it is that all of those concerns, if you wanted your child to play a sport, created an opportunity for soccer to grow?
I think it plays a part. I'm not sure I would say what percentage it is. I don't think there's one silver bullet, if you will, or one thing that caused it at all. But clearly, the costs you know, they're far less prohibitive than we see a whole bunch of other sports in terms of equipment, accessibility to fields, both indoor and outdoor, regardless of where you live in the country. There are so many great facilities in the United States to be able to go and participate. And as I say, I really also think because it hasn't necessarily been part of the long, long-term tradition, it now is starting to gain a significant amount of traction and why we're seeing some of these leagues thrive and more fans come out.
Ursel? Again, what do you think accounted for the growth? And I'll refine it and make it a little more particular to your situation. I mean, it was a little more than an interest for you. You decided to invest in it, basically. What prompted you to think, okay, this is something that I want to own, as it were?
Right. I would add on what Dave and Greg mentioned, that all those things they mentioned about the social media and globalization. I grew up in Turkey, so most of the world, this is the sport, and everybody wants to play because it's very accessible. And when I moved here in 1993, as David mentioned, you couldn't really watch anything. Mm-hmm. Every 4 years, maybe World Cup, you watch some games. And when I moved to the city 20-some years ago, there wasn't any place you can watch any games. And so it's completely became more accessible to everyone else, and I start watching back. I got disconnected, you know, overseas. And earlier 2000s, and I moved here. This is my permanent home, and I have, you know, married and have 4 kids, and I knew that this is going to be my permanent home forever. And I thought one day, if I have the resources, I'm a developer. You know, Keystone Group has become one of the largest developers in this state. I thought one day, you know, that continues to grow in soccer, love to bring the world's game to Indiana, and it will be amazing for us to contribute to growth of the soccer in the state. But more importantly, you know, I've became a fan of other sports, and I know that this is a sports town. The city leaders in the late 70s, they built the city based on sports business, and it is a large business, employs a lot of people, promotes the city and state nationally and internationally. So I thought it would be amazing to add another tier, the world's most popular game, that helps our city and state continue to be attractive. Would be a great place to do a quality of place for those people that we're trying to attract here from around the country as well as around the world. And so that was really an initiative to do. And I realized it's going to become really big when really Fox started Soccer Channel. And then 2004 and 2005, so personally for me, that's when I start paying more attention to MLS, saying that, you know, Rupert Murdoch is a smart businessman and he's not going to invest in two soccer channels for no reason. So that's really when triggered with the social media, Facebook and Twitter, because we were not able to get in the news globally. Your major one newspaper did not cover the sports, and you didn't have it on TV. So how else would you access to that? So I think the Facebook, Twitter, with the soccer channels from Fox Soccer to ESPN to now NBC Sports to BN to Gold TV to Univisions. So there's a lot of ways to now get sports on your phone and anywhere else, made it very accessible.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the future of the Indy 11 professional soccer team here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So before we're going to move on to more specific sort of road ahead questions and all of that after we come back. We've got a break here in a couple of minutes. What, you know, we've talked about the growth in this country. What accounted for the growth in this specific community? Because I think there were people in Indianapolis who were dubious about the viability of professional soccer. And, you know, what, you're drawing 10,000 or more pretty much every, you know, in every contest. So there's clearly a fan base. What do you think accounted for that, Greg?
I think a community that was probably somewhat starved for actually seeing the beautiful game here and having something that they could take pride in, right? I mean, it's it's their team, and so they may not fulfill that through NFL or NBA basketball or other things. So I think just the fact that It was going to be made available to them. I think is a big part of it, and that it was going to be here in a permanent sense. And so they've thrown their support behind it. And soccer has a lot of passionate fans around the world. So once you stir that inner being, so to speak, mm-hmm. they start to really follow. And you know, Indy 11 has done a great job of really gathering that momentum.
David, same question to you.
Yeah, you know, the Indy 11 have been very aggressive in really being out in the community at the grassroots level more than any, I mean, I've lived here my entire life, more than any minor or major league team that I've seen. I also think a strength in terms of even just the Indianapolis bid is the number of folks that we have living in our community that are under 24 years old, right? So a quarter of our population fits into that, significantly more than some of the teams that have been, or cities that have been awarded teams recently. And when you look at, you know, who follows soccer, it's much more followed and liked on the millennial side. So even some of our recent Indy Sports Poll data had a significant amount of more millennials liking and following the Indy 11 than Gen X and baby boomers.
And we are going to drill down on that when we come back from the break. We're talking about the Indy 11 today on No Limits. My guests are Indy 11 owner Ersal Ozdemir, Indy 11 CEO Greg Strumlaw, and IUPUI Director of Sports Innovation Institute David Pierce. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the Indy 11 professional soccer team. My guests are Indy 11 owner Ersal Ozdemir, Indy 11 CEO Greg Strumlaw, and the director of IUPUI's Sports Innovation Institute, David Pierce. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Bill has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bill, you're on the air.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to say I think it's a hello to all your guests there, and I think it's a very good thing that you're moving forward on this. My question is do you think it'll be more accessible? And I would say let's see here, for the stadium to go in the metro area and more profitable. And then the comment would be, I'm surprised they haven't done this soccer thing sooner.
All right. Well, thanks very much. And I think they're nodding their heads, too. So I think thank you very much for the call, Bill, and for the question. We'll see if we can get an answer for you.
All right. Thank you.
Certainly. Ersal.
Thank you, Bill. We agree with you. And, you know, there's 27 major league soccer teams and 36 teams in our league. And when we joined this league, this league was 8 members in 6 years. They've grown to 36, and from LA to New York to Tampa to, you know, Portland, so all around the country. And our bill that passed the Senate is Marion County. So right now it will be only in Marion County, and we believe that it's important. We are focused on areas that are going to cause a large neighborhood transformational development. Will have a big impact to redevelop a neighborhood, to kickstart energy and make sure that it has a large impact for the betterment of the neighborhood, not just for the soccer. So all the sites we're looking at are urban, and they are going to be sites that are mostly abandoned buildings or empty lands that will have large impact.
David, I'm going to put you in the hot seat here, if that's okay, because you can speak with a sense of detachment that's going to be harder for either of these two guys. And I'll put it in context. When we look at the viability, I mean, I think I know Greg and Ersal have said that this will be viable. We'll have good quality soccer. It will be a wonderful addition to the community, even if we don't, you know, become a major league soccer franchise. And I'm not disputing that or suggesting that it's not true. I want to talk a little bit about the chances, though, and the process of that happening and put it in a somewhat different context. Indianapolis has been a major market for many, many years, but never had a Major League Baseball team. And at least the conventional wisdom has been that at least part of the reason that hasn't happened is that the teams in Cincinnati, St. Louis, and Chicago are not thrilled, would not be thrilled with the idea of, you know, Indianapolis having a thing. What are some of the unspoken barriers to Indianapolis becoming a Major League Soccer town?
Sure. You know, there's not a long history of successful professional soccer. So the Indy 11 came on the scene in 2013, 2014. So still, you know, a fairly new thing. So you're looking at, you know, that level of strong fan support. But I think when you look, you know, the Indy 11 led the NASL 3 of the 4 years they were in that league. And they were third in overall attendance last year in the first year in the USL. And so you're looking at numbers in that 11 to 12,000 range across all those years. Those are pretty strong numbers given, you know, trying to play the first 4 years in Carroll Stadium, which we enjoyed at IUPUI. That was right outside my door. Could look out and see the games, but, you know, an aging venue for sure. And then trying to retrofit a little bit of the Lucas Oil Stadium, which is obviously a great facility, but not perfectly fit for soccer. So, you know, I think even in my sports sales class that I teach, the very first inaugural season, we actually partnered with the ticket sales director Mike Inn, and we're on the phone making tickets, and I was just selling tickets, and I was just amazed at how many people invested in that first season just to support soccer. It was just, we are happy that soccer is here. We are excited, and we have no idea what this team is going to look like or what the stadium is going to be like, but we're buying, we're in for soccer. And so I think, you know, they kind of use that as kind of the starting point in year one and have grown in to where it is. You know, corporate support is another challenge. You know, can you fill all the suites across IMS and then Victory Field and Bankers Life Fieldhouse and Lucas Oil Stadium? But, you know, but the bottom line is there's a unique, you know, demographic really in play with millennials and also with a more diverse audience. And so they're sponsors to dying to really get their marketing message to that group. And so while, you know, Indy 11 may be, you know, behind the eight ball and cultivating all those relationships over the years compared to some of the other professional teams, there's clearly a strategic fit for corporate partners that really want to reach the audience that the Indy 11 is bringing in. So I think they can overcome that concern a little bit as well.
Greg, what communities, you know, in this quest, which ones do you see as your primary competition?
A competition in terms of if it was MLS related?
An opportunity, you know. Go ahead. Yeah, we'll start with there.
I was going to build off of, it's public information in terms of which some of those other cities are that are vying for MLS, and that's why I keep coming back to it's important to get the stadium. It's important that we have a soccer-specific facility. Our goal this year is really clear. We want to lead the league of the USL. Ursal's talked about 36 teams. That's a pretty big professional league. Yeah. For us to be best in class in fan experience, to lead the league, go from third, our goal this year will be to lead the league in attendance. Mm-hmm. That turns heads. So right now we're focused on trying to be the best in the USL. And with that, along the way, also trying to get a soccer-specific state-of-the-art facility. Those two things going hand-in-hand really do start to create a strategic pathway towards other opportunities in the future. So that's what we're focused on right now, and I'm feeling very confident that this year is going to, again, continue that momentum.
How many people would you have to draw to get to number one? I mean, if you're at number three.
As long as all the other variables don't change, and that being that new stadiums aren't created, et cetera.
We presume that there's growth going on in these other communities, so it's constantly
I mean, right now, if we're at 11 or 12,000 average season attendance, we'll be right there vying for number one in the league, which we're taking a run at. So,
What's your long-term goal, Ursal? How many people would – suppose you get the stadium built and things go as you wish, how many people do you want to see? Coming to see
our
11 soccer.
The 20,000 seat capacity is the capacity. You look at other venues we have and around the country, you know, not every team actually fills it up every game. Mm-hmm. But you do need to have a little larger capacity to able to sell out some games, and some games maybe not. So we were proposing an 18,000, you know, average attendance for a 20,000 seat capacity, assuming that we'll sell out some games, and some games you can't, because we can't predict a sellout game forever, every game. So our goal is 18,000 plus per game, and we believe we can do that. Cincinnati was in our league until this past year. They were doing more than that. They moved to MLS this year. And so we believe that Indianapolis is also over 2 million metro. Our TV market is about 3 million people. So it's also the city's growing. It's not just the same old city 30 years ago. We have more people and more millennials, more internationals here that actually like soccer. So
that's a really important point. I mean, I think the market demographics in terms of being the 28th largest TV market, the 16th largest city, having the high percentage of the residents be millennials, I mean, all those things compare, frankly, better than the four most recent teams that have been awarded a franchise and are very competitive with the six or seven key players.
We've gotten an email from a listener named William. And again, if you want to join the conversation by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. William writes, I don't think the focus should be an MLS team. I think the focus should be building a fan experience that isn't found anywhere else in Indianapolis. We've got that going for us now, and it will only improve if we have a stadium to call our own. I'm going to, William, if it, I might, I'm going to take the liberty of reframing that slightly. You do hear that occasionally, like, you know, my son's a baseball player, so I spend a lot of time around baseball parks, and there is a large contingent of folks out there who say the minor league baseball experience is actually much better than the major league baseball experience. You get closer to the players, you can be closer to the experience, and you feel like you are part of the game much more than if you're in a big league stadium. Is that a concern that you know, you could destroy what has been or at least damage what has been a pretty satisfying experience for the fans already? Is that something you're worried about at all? Greg, you're the one who's locking in on me, so I'm going to you.
Yeah, it doesn't faze me in the least, to be quite honest. I think it would if we're talking going from a 2,000-seat stadium to a 100,000-seat behemoth. But right now we're drawing crowds that are significant already. For us to be best in the league and best in class in fan experience, I truly believe we're going to do that, whether it's, you know, in the current stadium that we're in or in a brand-new soccer-specific stadium. If anything, I think it'll be enhanced. Again, we're talking 20,000 seats, and I personally believe that we can do that tomorrow if the stadium was available. So it doesn't cause me any concern whatsoever. That's my personal opinion.
David,
I think it's very important for that's a great question. For those that have been to IUPUI to watch the games, we have a very different experience than any other sports. And our fans, Brickyard Battalion is the fan supporter group, started before even we had a team. Mm-hmm. They had a website and Facebook page and wanted to bring a professional team. So this is a very organic and grassroots efforts, and they stand the whole game behind the goalpost and sing songs. Mm-hmm. We used to be able to do smoke bombs every time we score. We lost that culture, which is an important part of it. Moving to Lucas Oil Stadium, we're not able to do that. But as you mentioned, William, it is important for us that whatever we do, mm-hmm. you know, even with the new stadium, if we go to MLS or not, it's important to make sure that we keep the soul of the organization and the spirit that helped us to become a special organization, special club going forward. So we're gonna do everything we can to make sure if we move to a new venue, regardless size or not, we're going to keep that soul of the organization, the spirit that made us what we are today.
David.
Yeah, and part of the fan experience here is really the location that the stadium mm-hmm. gets built in. So if you take you know, one of the proposed areas of the Valspar property, that would really connect Lucas Oil Stadium, right, and that mm-hmm. kind of southern core of the sports facilities to you know, that property there, the old Valspar property off of kind of Kentucky mm-hmm. Avenue. If you think about all the different pieces they're going to be part of this, you know, it's the hotel, it's the retail shopping. I mean, there's meeting space. I mean, that in and of itself creates an environment. You're not even inside the mm-hmm. venue yet. And then where that location is, that essentially would connect to the, I had it written down here, the waterside development on the old GM stamping plant. So you're really creating a connected pathway there from Lucas Oil to the new Indy, potentially one of the locations they're talking about on the old Valspar property, and then right across the river to the property, the new development on the GM stamping plant, which, if, you know, I take a walk from my office every once in a while and walk down south along the White River. Great trail, a totally underutilized asset in the city, but this could be a linchpin to connecting those three properties together. So I think just even in terms of like public perception, a lot of this, you know, kind of depends on like what is the, you know, specific location in the proposal in the field. So to answer William's question, I think, you know, fan experience is much broader than just what happens when I sit down in my seat.
Well, let me ask this then. What, you know, I know that the stadium is something you want regardless of whether the MLS becomes a reality or not. How would becoming an MLS franchise enhance the fan experience in any way? How would it change or alter things? Greg?
From my perspective, I mean, it's a lot about brand. So right now, MLS has done a really great job, in my opinion, in terms of enhancing their brand and their penetration and education in the marketplace. So there's a bit to be said about that experience. Exposure, again, you're playing against the top teams in all of North America, and therefore you're accessing other fans and other followers. And back to broadcast media, social media, et cetera, we know that MLS has an enhanced capacity there. But overall, in the stadium itself, our plan would be that that's going to be a heightened experience regardless of which league that we play in. I think William's question is a perfect one. It's more of a comment, and that's, I think, aligning with what I was trying to say earlier. That really is truly our number one priority.
Would it enhance the level of competition at all or increase it?
Well, that's a subjective question. I think that most soccer people around the table would say, I mean, if you're going to be in MLS, you're in the best league in North America in the sport. So I'm not here to pick on any leagues. I'm just saying I think that's a pretty known commodity right now. I'll look at David and Ursal if they have a different opinion on that.
Yeah.
But remembering, we're not talking a low-rate other leagues that we're talking about. We're talking about a very substantive league with USL. We're just saying that right now, as it currently stands, I think most would agree that play soccer or in the sport of soccer in North America, that MLS is at the top of the food chain.
We're talking about the Indy 11 here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Dave has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just always apprehensive about sports venues, especially with Indy's history of getting taken to the cleaners with stadiums, i.e. Lucas Oil Stadium, that we get sucked in on the front end with this big elaborate plan and take the lion's share of the input as far as the building of it. And then the owners and players and certain individuals walk away with the big slice of pie, and everybody else is left footing the bill for maintenance and upkeep and security. And, you know, anyone who's ever got online and looked at the CIB contract with the Colts know what a horrible bath Indianapolis took on that. Not only that, but the surrounding counties, including Shelby County, where I live, where we have to pay a 1% Colts tax every time we buy fast food.
Okay.
I don't see the economic benefit. I see a lot of money up front that doesn't pay back.
Thanks very much for the call, and we'll see if we can get someone to address your concern, Bill. David, I'll start with you. Thank you.
Yeah, so I mean, he laid out the arguments against public subsidy for sports venues pretty clearly there. That hit the main topic point. So we actually partnered with the IU Public Policy Institute and Drew Classic 3 years ago, and did a study on the comprehensive benefit of the sport industry. So Ursel mentioned a bit ago about the city sports strategy back in the 1980s. So the sports as a whole, so this is, you know, more than just, you know, Lucas Oil Stadium or the Indianapolis Colts, but sports as a whole represents 2.7% of the Indianapolis economy and contributes over $8 million of direct spending annually. So we're talking about something that has played out, you know, over the years as being a critical component to economic development in the city. So we asked residents recently, hey, you know, do you believe that sports has a positive effect on the area and the economy? And with a poll of 840 people in central Indiana, 87% of people agreed with that. And then when asked, hey, is this a good deal for taxpayers? Two-thirds or 67% agreed that it was a good deal for taxpayers. So I think that, like, the overall structure here in Indianapolis is people have, you know, seen the benefit and respond positively to those questions. Now, when you ask them specifically about, you know, a stadium for a specific team, those numbers tend to be lower. But that's where, you know, the important details about exactly, you know, where is the stadium going to be located? You know, how is it, you know, people want more detail. So when we asked a question about the Indy 11 back in December, you know, the number that came back was pretty low, 23%, but it was before anything was in the news, and it was just a broad global question without a lot of context.
And let me ask real quickly, because we're getting on time, what's the margin for error?
Plus or minus 4%.
So it could be as high as 91 and as low as 83 then on the public support, and correspondingly as low as 19 or as high as 27 back in December. And that these are moving targets, too, that they could be.
Yeah.
If you are just joining us, yeah, we've got to take a break, but I promise her, Sal, we'll come back to you first. We're talking about the Indy 11 today on No Limits. My guests are Indy 11 owner Ersal Özdemir, Indy 11 CEO Greg Stremlaw, and IUPUI Director of Sports Innovation Institute, David Pierce. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the Indy 11 and its future, including possibly a new stadium. My guests are Indy 11 owner Ersal Özdemir, Indy 11 CEO Greg Stremlaw, and the director of IUPUI's Sports Innovation Institute, David Pierce. Before we went to the break, we were talking about some polling and levels of public support, and the break ran in. Ersal, you wanted to respond to some of that.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I think it was Dave that asked the question. It's a very valid question. There's a general perception about these sports teams and the deals in the past. On one of the reasons we came up with the 11 Park, the neighborhood transformational project, was that we heard a lot about these. Our proposal 2015 was a stadium only.
Mm-hmm.
We're only saying we're going to build the stadium publicly owned, publicly financed, publicly operated, and then whatever it generates, we'll use that to, you know, to build the stadium. And understanding that there's a general census about, you know, some of the fans, some of the citizens are tired of these deals. That's one reason we came up with the project, is really a $550 million development to the central Indiana economy, state economy. A $400 million private development, privately financed. Mm-hmm. You're talking about apartments, retail, shops, and hotel. So the hotel is a smaller piece of the whole pie now.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, this is creating a district on its own that doesn't exist currently. Taxes don't exist. Those jobs don't exist right now. So understanding some of the sensitivities that are out there, that's one reason that we came back with the project that has a large private investment, making a large impact today, but more importantly, that it doesn't ask for one penny of state or city appropriations, knowing that some of the citizens are tired of these taxes. So our proposal that was submitted has not asking $1, one penny from state or city appropriations, not a state guarantee, not state financing. All we were asking is that we were to do privately invest $400 million to develop this mixed-use project. We'll do a district. We're only asking to use some of the taxes that we'll generate from our project. Mm-hmm. So, but for our project, these taxes don't exist. Using some of that to help with a publicly owned stadium, and will be built. And not only that, Dave also mentioned about operating expenses.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been an issue in the past with other venues. To address that, we're also proposed that Indy 11 leases the venue back from the city and pays for 100% of the operating expenses.
Mm-hmm.
So the taxes to build the stadium will be only generated from the taxes from our development. So if you live in Anderson or Shelbyville or Evansville or Indianapolis, you never come to a game or to the districted project built. You're not going to have to pay a dime of your taxes. If you do come to the venue and come to the project, the development, some of your taxes will be used to build a venue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
To even shield the taxpayers more, unlike any other deal has been done, we're also doing a developer-backed bonds. When we build this development, we're basically saying that if the city issues these bonds, and there will be a lot of levels of security in there, but even though there's some kind of a shortfall, year, whatever, 10, 5, 3, we're saying that developer, us, the ownership group is going to back it up to make sure that if there's a shortfall of the bonds, it will be on the private side. So that takes the debt issue, you know, to the private side, as well as operating concerns about shortfalls to the private side as well. Not only that, we're willing to pay for the shortfall of the stadium financing if there is anything. We plan to build a stadium for what the tax is going to generate. You know, that's our plan. But even though we decide to build a little bit nicer venue, we will pay the difference if that's necessary.
We are talking about the Indy 11 today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Huff has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Huff, you're on the air.
Thank you, John. A great show. I have a comment and a question for Ersal. I represent the largest and oldest sanctioned adult soccer community in Indiana, and I want to thank Ersal for all his passion and all his work on behalf of everybody. The question I have for him is, how can the fans, our members, our soccer community help Ersal to get the bill passed for the stadium? And thank you for your help.
Oh, certainly. Thanks for the call, Huff. Ersal.
Huff, thank you for your support and all your hard work. The amount of support we have in adult and youth leagues around the state is what's helped us to get here. Your specific question about how you can help, we have a website, 11-park.com, www.11-park.com. It's a very basic website. It talks about the project, talks about that we're not asking a penny state or city appropriations. It also has a little tech action section that talks about, it takes about 30 seconds. You put your name, your address, and email, and you click a button. It sends an email to your legislator, wherever you are in the state of Indiana. And before the Senate bill passed, within a week of that, we had over 5,000 members around the state. Every district in the state has sent an email to their legislator, one or a couple hundred, depends on the district you're in, to do that. So that was very important for the legislator to hear that there's a statewide support, and your support and your member support will mean a lot if you go to 11-park.com and then fill out that tech action site. Thank you for your support.
Gotten an email from a listener named Peter. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Peter writes, I was listening and I had a question for the guest but cannot be on the phone at work to ask. What's the plan long-term for the team if the bill passes with the MLS stipulation, but 11 doesn't get in MLS? Is that a problem? Ersal, you've been carrying the load here so far in this segment, but you're the one who's making eye contact. I'll throw it back to you.
Well, we have said this 6 years now, to have a permanent we need a permanent venue for our team to sustain and survive and be very successful. Our goal is to be one of the best clubs in the country, whatever league we played. And we've said that we're the world's game Indiana's team. So we are going to, obviously the bill is in the House, and we're going to be having discussions to see what the appetite is and discuss about some of these issues there. Our desire is to make sure that we have a permanent home for Indy 11, USL, and we will continue on the approach with MLS, but we do need a stadium with or without MLS.
We are talking about the Indy 11 on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. As Marianne has done. Marianne, you're on the air.
Sure. Would love to see a soccer stadium and a lot of plans. That's great. This has kind of, though, gotten tangled up in a couple of education bills at the legislature, which I think most people aren't aware of, specifically House Bill 1461, I think, which not only applies to Indianapolis, but to the entire state, and would require public schools to hand over empty buildings that they might have to close because of shortages in funding very quickly to charter or private schools. That I doubt if that's really your intention. And it's also tangled up, I think, with maybe plans to open two charter schools in any development that might be done. Would you consider decoupling those issues from the stadium proposal so that those of us who are worried about cuts to our public schools that have the wonderful soccer fans and teams could really get behind the project?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Marianne Ersal. It looks like you're up again.
Thank you for your support, Marianne. I appreciate that. So our bill is actually, as it was filed, Senate Bill 543, which is now part of Senate Bill 7. It is part of the Indianapolis CIB bill. So our bill actually does not have specifically anything to do with schools or charter schools. We are a Keystone Group, my development company. Recently, we purchased a building to put Purdue Polytech. Purdue is a great school. I'm an alumni of Purdue, and they are looking for a place to put a school in Broderpool. And with that, they have kids starting in July, and they didn't have a building, so we decided to buy a building to put them in the short term, and then to find a permanent solution. So, but that is not really part of the stadium bill as it stands. So we're part of the Senate Bill 7, part of CIB bill, and currently that bill does not have anything with the charter schools or any schools requirement part of the bill.
What are the obstacles, Greg, going forward? Do you anticipate the equivalent of a 48-1 vote, which I guess in the House would be 96-2, but assuming a couple of abstentions or people being away, do you anticipate that level of support, or do you think it'll be a tougher road going forward?
I try not to get caught too much in numbers. I think a win's a win, and so we're trying to get this done regardless of what the ultimate vote is, and obviously if that's a majority, then we're pleased with that. So it does not need to be a landslide. If it is, then so be it. But I think the big thing for us is just to make sure that this gets done because it's the right thing.
So let's assume that it gets passed and you know becomes law. How soon does the stadium get built?
The plan right now, if it goes according to what we've pitched, is we would be looking to open the new facility for the home opener of the 2022 season.
Okay, so about 3 years away then.
Correct.
Okay. And what other steps would there be between passage of the bill? Would it just be construction, or what else do you have to do? Rasal, they're looking at you.
Yeah, I'm obviously I'm an engineer, so the contract that I've this is my day job also. But the bill actually only allows us to work with the city of Indianapolis and CIB. You asked for 2, now it's 3 years. To come up with a plan, private-public partnership for the stadium. And the bill basically does, if we do come up with a plan with the city, it allows the city of Indianapolis, the CIB, capture future state and sales and income tax, part of it, in the district. These taxes currently don't exist. So most of the really work will be in the local level, you know, finalizing the location on the stadium with the council and the mayor's office, as well as the CIB. And the TIF district, all these actual taxes that even the state is allowing, it's an enabling legislation for the city to do. So the city council still has to enact on that to make sure that these are actually in place. So we'll be working with the city council, the mayor's office, and the CIB board to work out a deal that is taxpayer friendly, shields the taxpayers from any risk, as well as helps us to do 11 Park, the transformational neighborhood development with a 20,000-seat multi-purpose stadium.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the Indy 11. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Jeff has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, thanks, John. I just wanted to say that I think that the statistics that were put out by your guests today are particularly concerning. I mean, you've got a great idea, a great proposal and everything going on, but the statistics you're putting out are saying 840 people. The Census Bureau puts the population of Indianapolis and Marion County at over 800,000, almost 900,000 people. If you include the metropolitan statistical area, the donut counties around, you're looking at 2.5 million people almost. Those are the people who are going to be taxed according to the other listener's proposal. So when you're talking and throwing around numbers in an era where facts are important and the distinction between true facts, false facts, alternative facts, and relevant facts, to put out a statement that so many percentage believe in this, 2/3 of the people believe in this proposal, when you have it based on only 840 people, less than 1,000 people out of millions, that's really disingenuous. And I find it very concerning that your guests would put those facts out there as one of their strongest reasons for their proposal. I think it weakens their argument.
Yeah, so just
thanks very much for the call, Jeff. David, I'll let you respond.
So just to clarify those numbers, so in the survey that we did in the local market, the results were that 67% believe that the sports strategy is a good deal for taxpayers. That's the overall Indianapolis sports strategy for economic development, and that 87% believe that sports overall sport had a positive effect on the area and the economy. So when it came to the Indy 11 public funding, that number overall was lower. And as we were talking about at the break, that overall number was 23%. But the key about that number in context is that 23% number, we collected the data at the end of December. And so there was no information out there at all about 11 Park or any of the specific, you know, the tax increment financing and predominantly shielding taxpayers and not, you know, taxpayers not putting in a dime. So it was really kind of, I think of it as a pretest. I would love to go back and once there's a specific proposal out there, go collect more data from local residents. So just wanted to clarify what that kind of that two-thirds number represented. And again, given the local demographic market size, when you look at margin of error, it's plus or minus 4%.
We've gotten a bunch of emails with questions here. I'm going to try to click them off real quickly because we're getting very close on time. One of them, it's an email from Kevin who takes it in a somewhat another direction and asks if there are any plans or any hopes that we'll get women's minor league soccer here in Indy. Ursal, everybody's looking your way.
Well, it's public information. We proposed that we would add not minor league, we would add major league women's team. Mm-hmm. And most of these teams are owned by MLS teams. There's 9 right now. They're slowly growing. Our women's national team won the World Cup, 15. We do have the best women's national team. So, and last year we were very close. The commissioner of the league, the federation CEO came down, and we have done a great job in Indianapolis. They love Indianapolis. They would love to see one here, but the scheduling is impossible for us to do at Lucas Oil Stadium. And so what we have said that, you know, we would love to see a women's professional team here when we build the new stadium. With the new stadium, we believe, like India, Pacers does with Fever, having a venue that we can control the schedule, then we will be able to book the women's games a lot easier and control the venue and able to program it for both. I have 3 girls. I have 4 kids and 3 are girls. So I'm all for the women's soccer here as well in the future.
We're getting very close to the end here. And I think that probably would have to be the last question. I am going to ask, though, because I've got a full screen here of people. Ask if the 3 of you would be willing to continue the conversation on our Facebook page. You know, and take questions there. And I would say to our listeners, if you could go to our Facebook page and present your questions there, then perhaps our guests could listen. You'd be willing to do that? I see a lot of nods.
Absolutely. Sure.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank my guests, Ursal Ozdemir, Greg Stremlaw, and David Pierce for what has been an invigorating and enlightening conversation about soccer in Indianapolis. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting station.